Se jubeos placitant varis liberate manus.
Nobilis humilis manie martyr stabilis habilis utilis comes serva carnis fragilis mole potito.
Hi, I'm Stan Brakhage. I'd like to play for you today some recordings of a man that I can't really call a close friend, though I felt extremely close kinship with him in high school. When I read his works in, of all places, the South High School Denver Library, the works of Kenneth Patchen. Later, I was to meet him, spend several evenings with him, and I'll tell you a little about that story. I was especially moved by his poems for Miriam, love poems to his wife, which so inspired me that I had extraordinary images of her created in a kind of, tawdry 50s beauty, but also sort of diaphanous and wispy. She became one of the figures in a whole line of poetics that were my dreams of loving women to come. And when I met her, I was not prepared to recognize the beauty that she had. She was strong, powerful, short, elderly woman who came to the door and invited me in to the home of Kenneth Patchen. And it took me a little while to realize and then fully believe that this was the beautiful Miriam sung of in the poems. Then it was an important lesson for me because I began to see a kind of beauty that male chauvinism had not ever prepared me for. Patchen also was a disturbance. My use of him in high school was his belligerent outcry against the draft, how he would kick the master sergeant rather than allow himself to be examined as fodder for what would then be the Second World War. Actually, when I met him, he had been through many back operations and was flat on his back, weak, pale, in obvious pain, and being very much cared for by Miriam. There are a lot of different stories about Patchen, what happened. He never would have had the strength anyway, or would simply have ended in prison had he met a sergeant or anyone else as forcefully as his poem wanted him to. And somewhere before his actual induction into the war, he slipped and fell down the stairs and had the first of back injuries, which were compounded by operation after operation. But the spirit was exactly what had drawn me as a young man in high school. It was a spirit against, well, and for, well, he'll speak better for himself. Patchen is one of those people who everyone seems to know about, who reads a great deal, and who's recognized, and whose books are kept in print, but whom, for reasons I think his own voice will tell to you, who is ignored largely by the literary world or by any other kind of establishment. But the young keep coming to him like I did in high school and still do. And what I want to play are some of his selections from the great book, The Journal of Albion Moonlight. I'll play a number of these today and then later sort of play sections of it until the whole of it has been heard, because it is, in fact, it does fall beautifully into a journal, a voice now, alas, as Patchen's dead, that comes from the other world with the most startling news that you will not find in the newspapers. Kenneth Patchen reading the Journal of Albion Moonlight.
From the Journal of Albion Moonlight, May 2nd. The angel lay in a little thicket. It had no need of love. There was nothing anywhere in the world could startle it. We can lie here with the angel if we like. It couldn't have hurt much when they slit its throat. The evening slowly turns to black stone, and the hammer of God chips at the sky, making stars. A child stands on the road watching us. Upon her forehead is the yellow brand of this plague summer. She waves to us, and her hand, like a withered white claw, falls to the ground. The fingers unclench once. Very well. We knew we had no other course but to get away with all attainable speed. A light rain had fallen in the night, and morning brought the drizzle to storm proportions. Our coats were wet through as we sogged out of New York on the first leg of our trip. That a great distance separated us from our goal, we knew. That we were in danger of destruction at any hour of the day and night, we knew. What we did not know was how near madness we would be, how alone, how defenseless, how beset we would be with what we had heard, with what we had been taught. This especially we did not know. May 18. The first communication from Roybus. After informing us that he would be unable to appear in Galen during the period set for our meeting, he gave warning of an exact, definable danger. May 19. I have forgotten my mask, and my face was in it. We have come at last to a huge hotel where we may rest and refresh ourselves. Its windows front the river on one side, on the other, stretching away as far as I can see, lies a great open space pitted by what would seem to be great shell craters. The proprietor tells us that within the memory of the oldest resident, no human being has ever walked upon this plain. The hand of someone moves over my throat. I have no fear. A whale with a sad smile swims past me. The waves are red as blood. The human race has bled to death here. A great steel coffin churns through the water. There are buildings falling. I'm cold. Put your arms around me. I have seen Roybus, I tell them. Could you see his face? No. Then how do you know it was he? Because the birds were pecking at his eyes. What makes you think anyone will understand that? Joseph Gambetta asks. I don't worry about it. You're always playing high and mighty. And telling the truth, man has been corrupted by his symbols. Language has killed his animal. And you are resurrecting it? No, it has never had an opportunity to live. What will you do about it? I shall continue to ask how. How to what? To this strange, unborn thing which is in all men. You'll be easy picking for the scoffers. I have no interest in that. I see men engaged in activities that would shame a grub under a rock. Their codes and ambitions leave me sick with disgust. I suppose you'd like to try your hand at being God. No, I'd like to try my hand at being. I've armed myself against their weapons. To be so indolent that the flies will bury the dead on my eyelids. Sit on a beach and let the waves comb all thought of endeavor out of me. To live in such a manner that I never make a single blood-rotted dollar. To study history in order only to have it to forget. Books, all those big fat-bottomed ash cans where men empty their lives. The great man fell asleep with open mouth in a room full of flies. And that day his work took a gloomy turn. The man was Marcel Proust. The flies were Tommy and Winnie and little Meg. They're all dead now.
I think before talking any more about Kenneth Patchen or anybody else, I'd like to play the last piece of music composed by Lily Boulanger as she's dying in 1918 in Paris, France. Pia Jesu.
Thank you.
not to be unrelentingly solemn today, though when solemnity comes to such beauty as that. And Patchen's anger and sorrow, sadness, also comes not only to this, some of the things that you've heard already, but to a great beauty and even exorbitant wit. But today the mood seems to be different. Maybe in a way one should be glad that so fragile a person, though so strong a composer as Lili Boulanger, didn't have to survive more than one world war. In dying in 1918, she was spared the breakdown of all world's peaceful inclination and the Second World War, which put Patchen on his back, and some people 6 feet under, of course, thousands, millions. Patchen did live out his life, though, very much like an encoffined poet. His disgust, as you've heard already, was so complete. He never did, so far as I know, come to a peace and resignation like Lily did. And these two, thinking of these two people and their relationship, Patchen, by the way, and I mean it should be said, was not the kind of saint either that he sounds in his journals any more than he was the strong man who boasted in rhyme and rhythm of hitting the master sergeant. He was a fairly cantankerous man. In fact, the reason I didn't ever get to know Patchen better was that at the time in San Francisco, which should be to say early 50s, you could either belong to the Kenneth Rexroth group of poets, or you could belong to the gathering around Kenneth Patchen. You could not belong to both. You quickly had to choose. You were given about 3-4 weeks to choose between the two. This was mostly at Kenneth Patchen's insistence. So this man who wrote so eloquently against war was waging the strongest possible one that he could from a sofa against one of the other most interesting poets of his own city. And in fact, it went further than that. The rifts became very strong. If you went to Kenneth Rexroth's, you also could know Robert Duncan and other people, and otherwise not. So within a few weeks, when I had to make my choice reluctantly, I began attending regularly Rexroth's salons and didn't embarrass the Patchens with that by going to their home further. Both Patchen, Kenneth, and Lily lead me inevitably to one of the greatest poets of our century, who also isn't nearly as well known as she should be, H.D., which stands for Hilda Doolittle. There's a poet that survived both those world wars and had almost the full brunt of both of them. Dear friends perishing senselessly in the trenches of the First World War, the whole world gone mad, and then all the beliefs between the wars that had been the war to end all wars, and then the monstrosity of the Second World War, which she sat out in London amidst the Blitz bombings. She's a woman who tends to only get into literature of most people because she was the girlfriend of William Carlos Williams. She was the fiancée of Ezra Pound, who sort of swept her off her feet over to London in the early teens of this century. She married another writer, Aldington. She was the great love, one of the great loves, of D.H. Lawrence. The record on that is obscure and deliberately hidden, so that the proof of it almost comes from the extent to which Aldington, her husband, and she herself have tried to conceal it. But in the new book by Janice S. Robinson, H.D., The Life and Work of an American Poet, a biography of Hilda Doolittle, the case is made. as strong as I think it can be on the on what is finally rather weak evidence, unless you turn to the poems, both of D.H. Lawrence and Hilda Doolittle, in which the astonishing thing emerges that she probably is the major model for Lady Chatterley in Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover. Whether that's true or not, it should be. It should be someone as graceful and fantastic and beautiful and intelligent and spiritually kin to him in a way. And also, it should be someone who was strong enough in herself to resist his macho and make her own song. Whatever it is, H.D. writes of war during the Second World War and afterwards from a perspective which she creates for herself. Suppose it were true, as an early Greek poet had conjectured, that Helen never was at Troy, that Helen had been spirited away to Egypt, and that there later, that Achilles was never killed at Troy, and that later he had met her in Egypt on a beach. H.D., a very old woman, who not only should be the model for Lady Chatterley, but maybe if God is a woman, God should sound something like this, reads, from an asylum in Switzerland, not too long before her death, passages from her great poem, Helen in Egypt, beginning with the section where, how did we greet each other, meaning Helen of Troy and Achilles.
In the sanctuary of the great Amen temple, Helen recalls her first meeting with Achilles and her invocation or prayer to his mother, Thetis, the sea goddess, a Greek incarnation of the Egyptian Isis. How did we greet each other here in this Amen temple? I have all time to remember. He comes, he goes. I do not know what memory calls him or what spirit master summons him to release, as God released him, the imprisoned, the lost. Few were the words we said, but the words are graven on stone, minted on gold, stamped upon lead. They are coins of a treasure or the graded weights of barter and measure. I am a woman's pleasure, I spoke ironically into the night, for he had built me a fire, he Achilles, piling driftwood, finding an old flint in his pouch. I thought I had lost that. Few were the words we said. I am shipwrecked, I am lost, turning to view the stars swaying as before the mast. The seasons different, we're far from. Let him forget. Amen, all Father, let him forget. We huddled over the fire, was there ever such a brazier? A night bird hooted past. He started, a curious flight, a carrion creature, what? Dear God, let him forget. I said, there's mystery in this place, I'm instructed, I know the script. The shape of this vase is a letter, they call it the hieroglyph. Strive not, it is delicate to the goddess here, she is Isis. Isis, he said. Or Thetis, I said, remembering, recalling, invoking his sea mother. Flame, I prayed, flame, forget, forgive and forget the other. Let my heart be filled with peace. Let me love him as Thetis, his mother, for I knew him. I saw in his eyes the sea enchantment, but he knew not yet Helen of Sparta, knew not Helen of Troy. knew not Helen, I hated the priest.
So, that's H.D. reading from the long poem, the epic poem, Helen in Egypt. And I'll be playing more of that on other days, but once again, we're out of time.
Thank you.